Joining us now is, we'll do a change away from this topic, Guard Goldsmith. Great to talk to you, Guard. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, David. And terrific conversations. I agree with you 100%.
Well, I won't throw you into that that briar patch, but
No, I was just sitting here having my moolik meat and mealworm on the side meal, and I just thought, I got to join the future. I don't know. It's just I need to learn all this new stuff. Hey, by the way, I just wanted to compliment you again for bringing up. I literally had this right next to me when you brought up Cold Case Christianity. Oh. And I got it because of you.
Wow,
so
thank you
so much. You've thank done you. So much to help me. And
that's Jay Warner Wallace who did that. He did a great job, and he had an interesting journey to get to that point. Really was a very interesting book.
Absolutely.
That he's got there. When we're looking at this, well, they really do want us into some kind of a Soylent Green thing, isn't it? Isn't it amazing how they just take all these science fiction movies and they start implementing them, whether Soylent Green or 1984 or Brave New World? I mean, it's crazy.
It's crazy. They disconnect you from the natural world and how you might feed yourself and getting connected to the soil and getting connected to your neighbors. And as you were talking about with the psychedelics, disconnecting from God and changing your biochemical state in such a way that you're actually connected to a shaman to do something about that. It's just, it's crazy. And, you know, to bring it up, you talked about that, crime spree, the murder spree in Maine, and whether or not the man was on psychoactive drugs. Nobody's really talking about that.
That's right.
So why isn't that part of the conversation?
Isn't it interesting that when the Washington Post says, you know, so these psychedelics connect with a serotonin, and we don't really know what's going on there. And it's like, yeah, and you're not interested in finding out as long as it's the big pharmaceutical companies doing it. You might question it when it is coming up with something as a competitor to the pharmaceutical companies like magic mushrooms, but you're not interested in it when it's their SSRIs that's doing it. They don't want to talk about it at all.
Right. Yeah. And as you said, there's a difference between mandating and compelling people not to take these things through the force of the state, engaging in aggression to tell people don't do that, and preaching to people, just offering what I think is a good way to go. And you might want to try this. And, you know, I worked in a bookstore for many years part time, and we carried a lot of the Alcoholics Anonymous recovery material, the books, the recovery medallions for their 24 hours, the 1 month, and so on. So a lot of the anonymous guys would actually come in, and I'd have great conversations with them, learning about so many of the patterns that emerged in the conversations. And I would say, you know, I talked to this other guy. Is that similar with you? And it was always the things that I learned are actually very applicable to anybody, even if they don't have the classic, termed addictive problems, which is that they would typically look at their opportunity to ingest some sort of a drug and get away from things as their opportunity. It's their chance. They've sacrificed so much. Now it's my time to get away. So a mother would go into the car and drink or, you know, do something like taking heroin or something like that, because they just felt that this is my time to withdraw and get away. And this is my release valve.
Yeah.
And I found that, you know, I think a lot of us feel those sorts of feelings. It's just, if you've got those, especially if you've got that tendency, how do you guard against that and protect yourself and make it a fruitful thing to release a little bit of pressure? Mm-hmm. How do you do it in a positive way? Can you help somebody else while you're doing it and have fun?
Right.
Can you learn
right.
something?
Yeah. You know, we can do that in a lot of different ways. I mean, we can get, we can escape by watching TV or movies or sports or something like that, or we can get obsessed with it. You know, we can make it so that all we do is sit there and watch TV. And now we're not living our life, or we've lost our life because we're sitting there on the couch in front of television all the time, especially, you know, with sports. Somebody can become a real sports fanatic, or they can, there's nothing inherently wrong with it unless it becomes this thing that you lean on because it's an escape out of life. And then when it's this thing that you're trying to escape with, and it kind of takes over your life, that's when it becomes bad. And of course, that can be anything. It could be food, you know, it could be anything in your life as it starts to dominate and take over your life and take you out of life. At that point, it becomes evil. But yeah, you're right. We're not trying to, even things that I would think are harmful, I'm not trying to get the government to ban them, except, as I said, the mRNA, because I believe that's an outright poison, a kill shot. But in general, I don't believe in prohibition. And I'm not trying to get any force anybody into a particular religion or to agree with me in religion. And yeah. I don't want the government doing that either, because what happens is the government winds up destroying that church that it joins. And so it joins the church and then destroys the church. And we know people like that too, you know, but.
So true. So true. Look what they've done with marriage, for goodness sake. You know, it's, and thank you again for about a year ago, reading that piece that I wrote about marriage on Substack. You know, don't put the state before God when it comes to marriage, you know, going into the history of it and how they tried to stop blacks and whites from marrying. It's supposed to be a religious ceremony. And if you're going to get the government defining what marriage is, and you're going to have command and control, central control of things, you're not going to get what you want, because the people who are going to be in charge won't be the people eventually that you want to be in charge.
That's right. And marriage is a good example. It really is a good example of the mixture of church and state, because it was a religious thing, and then the government gets involved in it. The next thing you know, government has defined it, and defined it in a way to match with their religion of secular humanism, for example, and then prohibited all other opinions about marriage. And that's what they do in a broad sense on any kind of religion. When you have the government getting into a religion, they're going to wind up taking it in a direction that you probably don't want.
Yeah. And, you know, it reminds me actually of that statement from 19th century, the 19th century economist Frederick Bastiat, political philosopher, where he said, the state is that great fiction by which everyone endeavors to live off of everyone else. And as perhaps as some folks want to celebrate Halloween, it is very vampiric. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, because it removes people, because they think everything's being decided in this sandbox. More toys have been thrown into the sandbox, and they don't see that it comes at the expense of their neighbor. It comes at their expense. They see it as coming at their expense. So I have to dive in too. I have to decide how this is going to be steered. I've got to get aboard this ship. And no, I don't want it. This is the moral culpability that is the problem. You know, we've discussed on my streaming show, we've discussed Israel and Hamas. Mm-hmm. And I constantly hear, especially conservative talk radio hosts, they're saying, well, what are we going to do about it? And it's the all-inclusive government statist we. It's like, no, I don't want to be part of your we. Why are you taking the royal we and claiming that somehow it represents me? This is, and I mentioned on my show as well, the New York Times bomber, the one of the very few who actually was a terrorist that they got a number of years ago, he had a car and they ended up replacing the explosives that the guy thought that he was going to blow up in Times Square, not New York Times, Times Square. And they asked him, how do you plead? And he said, I'm almost quoting verbatim. He said, guilty, guilty, 1,000 times guilty. And if the U.S. government continues to do what it is doing in the Middle East, more American civilians are going to die, because they buy into the same canard that we do. It's the royal we that they've translated from, you know, old royal days, where the monarch was le tête, c'est moi, I am the state, to now you are all the state. It's all wonderful. It's kumbaya. It's we, and they wrap their arms around you through force. Just leave me alone. I don't want to be molested. Just leave me alone. I don't need Joe Biden sniffing my, well, I don't have any hair, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's we look at all the different things that the U.S. government does. I don't want that imputed to me. Yeah. That's not my policy. I don't support that. I didn't vote for that. And I don't agree with that in any way, shape, or form. And yet, that is the big issue. And so we need to understand the same thing about other people. That's what I said from the very beginning. You understand that the things that are done by the Israeli government to the Israeli people, using them as lab rats, but also to the Gazan people, that is not to be imputed to all the people living in Israel. The same thing goes of Hamas and the things that it does, not to be imputed to all the people living in Gaza. Just as I don't want what Biden does or Trump does imputed to me. You know, I mean, if that were the case, since we created this vaccine, I guess everybody would be justified in terms of wiping America off the face of the earth. because it's we sent so those right. shots around the world. I mean, it's crazy when you look at it. But we have to understand, you know, what's really going on. But everybody's getting their bloodlust up. And, you know, and I see they brought journalists over to Israel, and Joel Pollack at Breitbart was one of the ones that they took over to show. And he was just, you know, people were throwing up when they showed them the pictures of what had been done to people. I understand that. And I wanted to throw up when I saw the pictures of what bombs had done to a little kid in Gaza. But you understand that it's not the visceral effect. We got to try to distance ourselves from that somehow and say, how do we break this cycle of violence? How do we get a lid on this thing instead of escalating it? And everybody on both sides seems to want to escalate this, and they don't want to go back and look at the long-term agenda that we've had for decades with the U.S. and with Israel as well, with Netanyahu. We got to get Iran. You know, that is, it's like, okay, so yeah. that's really what you're pushing us for. You've right. got this geopolitical goal, and you're going to use us as expendable for your geopolitical goal, and you don't care how many of your own citizens die, and you certainly don't care about the citizens in the other countries. As a matter of fact, you take that as a victory notch, you know, when you kill other people yeah. in other countries.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I look at it almost like a combination of pretzel logic and convoluted circus performing, where they have all these various convolutions, and they're very subtle. So, for example, the U.S. government will insert federal troops, U.S. troops, without any declaration of war, on the ground in Israel. They'll put them on the ground in Poland. And in Poland, Joe Biden actually acknowledges to the 101st Airborne. You'll find out about the Ukrainians. Oh, that's right. Some of you guys have already been there. Oh, really? I didn't know that you had them on the ground in Ukraine. Now you told us.
Yeah.
And then we have John Kirby talking about how, well, the advisors of the U.S. military, you know, they put it in air quotes, I suppose, the advisors of the U.S. military who are on the ground in Israel, they have a right to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
even that is a circumlocution of what is really the rights. Because, and I've mentioned this to people before, I said, listen, do they really have a right to, sure, they have the right to protect themselves, but if they're there illegitimately on somebody else's dime, and the weapons that they have, they didn't buy themselves, then what right exactly are they exercising mm-hmm. over there? Mm-hmm. You know, are they, I mean, if a mafia sends one of its mob guys to a new city with guns that they got through shaking down some of the local people in Brooklyn, does that man then have the right to use the fruits of ill-gotten gains, or is there a moral question there? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think there are major moral questions even in that sort of typical phraseology that we hear from people where they say, well, they obviously have a right there. Well, you're not questioning the fact that you put them there illegitimately. And if we're looking at the weapons that they've got, what if I don't want to pay for their weapons?
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
goes to the weapons, even if the people of the United States aren't there, or if we're looking at the weapons that they send over.
Well, Syria. Talk about justification. Okay, we could be invited into Israel, and I'm sure they would love to have additional troops in there to work with them. We were not invited into Syria. We invaded Syria. We set up bases in Syria, and then we had U.S. jets do attacks today, and they said they were retaliatory. Retaliatory
Absolutely.
For what? Retaliatory because we invaded, they attacked us in response to that, and so now we're justified to escalate that. That yeah. is the key issue, and we have done that over and over again. And so when you look at what is happening, Syria's a good example. They've got their agenda of what they want to do with oil. They've got their agenda with what they want to do with oil, with Iran, as well as with Iran's power base. And so this is about the geopolitics. This is about the long-term animosity between Iran and the U.S. that goes back to the 1950s when we overthrew their elected leftist leader who wanted to nationalize industries. But of course, in America, we just think it was... you know, the Shah was always there. He wasn't put in by us. We don't know that the CIA was training his secret police, and we don't care or know anything about about what he was doing to the people there. And then just all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, there's this radical Islamic regime that gets installed, and they hate Americans, and can't understand why they hate us.
Yeah, my formative years came without that knowledge of the foreground. to all of it. So I came in with exactly those thoughts. I thought, why do they hate Americans? You know, why is it that that they've done this? Oh, I just must, I must make sure that I don't like Iranians. Then I met a woman from Iran. She goes, well, you know, it used to be called Persia. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I was a kid. And I was like, what? She goes, well, let me tell you what happened. And I'm like, oh, I see. Okay. And you know, David, it's interesting as you mention it, because they have all these subtle means to, you know, that there's so many perverse incentives. Anytime that a government institution or something removed from individuals claims power. So we've got the jabs, we've got the pharmakia, we've got the perverse incentives to gin the system and make sure that their money goes towards promoting a particular so-called public health agenda. And as you brought up, there is no such thing as public health. It's individual health. So anytime you remove it from the individual or free association and you're applying mandates and so on to people, there is an incentive for people to get in to have those mandates steered to their benefit. Obviously, rent-seeking in economics, right? And we see the same thing with the military-industrial complex. Whether it's public health or so-called public defense, the further away, and the founders really understood this. You know, they wanted small, decentralized localities really running their own thing. And I think that, you know, the lessons from Exodus are very clear. If you look at before they had a king, you look at the system that they had the tribes, they had the families, they had the elders in the families who were the adjudicators. It's much like ancient Ireland, much like ancient Iceland. They had these localities, and it was mostly reputation. It wasn't statutes from the state thrown down at people. And I think that this is the sort of thing that a lot of people, they just sort of blithely go along with it because they think that they've got these protective machines in the government, and the machines are just they're designed to get taken over by people who will take advantage of them, whether it's the so-called defense industry or not. You know, we've got woman running for governor. Yeah, a woman running for governor right now named Kelly Ayotte here in New Hampshire. She's former U.S. senator. I used to see her around. She was the state attorney general. I used to see her in a Panera Bread up in the state, capital. And so she was a senator for a while. She got knocked out by a Democrat. She's part of the Rhino complex. She was on the board of BAE Systems at the same time, I believe, that she was on the board of Fox News.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
she's out there.
Big military-industrial corporation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there are all these perverse incentives that we don't realize. And one thing I'd like to mention to you, David, to go back to what you were talking about the pharmakia and so on. You know, for a number of years, it's taken me a while to learn this lesson, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But I think you and I discussed this once before. You know, having worked in television, I was at the Paramount studios when I worked at Star Trek Voyager. And you know, I really learned lesson coming from television. And here's that there's this fine line between consuming entertainment as a minor distraction and understanding that it is a distraction and living, yeah, living that entertainment world completely removed.
Yes.
And it's a very strange thing because I think with the with the pervasive nature of media, I was one of those people who I thought, I live in New Hampshire, but I can go to Los Angeles. I can write, I can do all these things. And it took me a while to really understand that lesson, that entertainment is just a minor distraction. And you can't constantly live in escapism. And I really got the lesson just recently. I was watching one of the old reruns of Mission Impossible, and I knew that they had shot it. I didn't know until afterwards. I thought, you know, those look like the buildings. They were pretending it was like Poland or something like that, you know. But you could tell it was Los Angeles. and they had Greg Morris and the guy, the big guy. They were setting up something in a van, some of the Mission Impossible members. It was from the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, you know, and they're pulling up, they pull up on this street, and you know it's somewhere in, you know, just around the corner from a soundstage or whatever now, because I worked at Star Trek, right? And so I thought to myself, gee, I wonder if that's Paramount. And I looked at it more closely, and I scrolled back, and they pull into this alcove, and it literally was an alcove that was just below my window at Paramount. And it's a weird thing, because then you start to realize how many generations of people have gone through that particular field of work, and just, you know, they've gotten a contract, they're doing a show, like a guy doing a contract to build a house or lay down pavement or whatever it is. You know, it's a place where you can do work. People invested in putting up the buildings. People come and go. They do their work. They do their shows like any other theater. And as I've gotten older, I've become much more aware of how easily you can get drawn into considering that artificial world to be real.
And that's what we've got to be really careful about with virtual reality, because it's becoming hyper real, it's going to be so controlling to people. That's funny. Now, you were at the Paramount Studios in California. That's where you were.
In fact,
which Star Trek generation were you working with? Was it?
I was at Star Trek Voyager, and in fact, my claim to fame, I never got my name on the credits because I was always so low on the totem pole, but my claim to fame is that, I hate to say this because Donald Trump, it's Operation Warp Drive, but I don't have the hair, but I'm the guy who saved Warp Drive. So what happened was, they had this season of Star Trek Voyager. You know, the premise for Voyager was that this crew of this Enterprise ship got teleported to some distant quadrant of the universe where nobody had ever gone. And it was going to take them years and years to get back. So they were having this adventure, a sort of lost in space sort of thing. They'd encounter new explorations as they worked their way back. And so they wanted to sort of speed things up. The time that they estimated at maximum warp drive to get back to the Federation space, it was going to be like 6 years. They're like, man, we're not sure if the show's going to last that long. Let's see if we can go faster. I'm like, I'm glad you're not operating an EV, you know? Oh, we got to pause here and recharge at this planet, you know? I see Jennifer Granholm is taking up all the spots. I don't know what's going on. So they had this story where they had an alien who gave them this thing called slipstream drive. And again, this is how, you know, it's entertaining and it's kind of fun. It's sort of like talking about if you're a baseball card collector or, you know, oh, I got this first edition of the Rolling Stones record or whatever. You know, it's entertainment and it's fun. But then you got to realize, like, okay, that's just a narrative, and it's just fun to talk about it, you know? It's like talking about your favorite, you know, Jules Verne story or something like that. It's entertaining, and hopefully you can draw a lesson from it. And that's really what I've been learning, as I mentioned with you before. But so I'm literally the Writers Guild fellow, and I'm like nobody. I've been there for like 2 days. Nobody even knows who I am, right? And so I'm sitting there hearing them talk about, well, yeah, we've got this alien and it's going to be called slipstream drive and it's going to be so much faster than warp speed. And I was like, well, at the end of this show, they're going to get back to the Federation. They're still going to have this technology. So that means like this classic thing, warp, is now going to be gone. They're going to get rid of it and they'll have this. So I didn't know what to say because I wasn't really in a position to talk and say, excuse me, you can't, you know, nobody knew who I was, right? So at the end, I knew Brandon Braga. He's the guy who created the Borg, and he's a pretty pro-liberty guy. I had lunch with him a few years ago. Nice guy. And so Brandon, I went out. We left the meeting. It was all the writers are all together in this thing they call the break session. And I was up at the board. I was the guy who had to write down all their ideas as we broke it down into acts and scenes. So they're going through it, and so I didn't mention anything during the meeting, but at the end of the meeting, I waited because I knew Brandon Braga would be the last guy to come out. So Brandon Braga comes out. He's one of the producers. And I say, hey, Brandon, that was a good meeting. He goes, yeah. What'd you think? Yeah. I was like, yeah, it was good. I was like, oh, by the way, that slipstream drive thing. He goes, yeah. I was like, does that mean that when the ship gets back to the Federation, warp drive won't be used in Star Trek from now on? And he's like, oh, we got to fix that. And I'm like, yes, you do have to fix it. So
That reminds me of that sounds like Wag the Dog, you know? Or
yeah.
We got this prisoner, we're going to bring him back. Oh, wait, we can't have this guy come back. Let's kill old Shoe.
Old Shoe. People are throwing their shoes up. That was the funniest movie.
But what was funny, the both sides knew that this thing was just a made-up narrative, and so they're releasing information to change the narrative on the other side to their advantage as they're going through this made-up narrative. That was quite a movie.
It really was.
It reminds me, when you're talking about that, I know we went out when the kids were, my sons were really small, we went out to Tahoe, and I had that feeling that it was really strange because, you know, I'd grown up with a Bonanza, and it was in the background on Sunday nights and stuff like that, you know, and so I would see it, and we're driving around there, and it's like, wow, the sense of deja vu that I've been here before was really amazing. Of course, the kids didn't have it because they didn't know what it looked like, you know, but it was this area where they had filmed it and you know, watched it for years and years when I was a kid. And then all of a sudden I'm there, and it was like being on the set, although they had been shooting it on the natural area. But I understand.
It is weird. Yeah. I had a similar experience in another instance. My buddy used to, he was staying at one of my brother's houses, and he had a dog. And so when I would finish work, I would go over to visit with the dog and let the dog outside, and he would leave the television on for the dog. And so I went in, and typically when I got there, Bonanza would be on. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those old, you know, like first season Bonanzas, a black and white. It was mostly soundstage with the backdrop that had been drawn, you know, with the prairies in the background and so on. And I was watching, I was like, I don't know why, but I just get a feeling they shot this at one of the Paramount studios. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Like, there's no reason to think that. It's just in a soundstage. So I waited for the, and sure enough, it was shot at Paramount, probably in the same soundstage where I was walking around, where they had built the Star Trek Voyager, toy to play in. And it really is. It's
well, you know, the interesting thing about it was the first couple of seasons they shot it on a soundstage, but then they would do some outside shots in that area. And then they decided, well, let's build the real thing out there. And, you know, they built a purpose-built house. And eventually, Lauren Green and Dan Blocker and Michael Landon all got involved in terms of a part ownership of this thing. And they set it up for tourists and stuff like that. But they actually did have a Ponderosa that they built. Physically built it, and they built in different areas where they could hide the camera. You know, already got the shots that are built into this actual building. But because they had been shooting it on the soundstage for a couple of years, they had to put the same background up. So they had to create kind of like a soundstage behind the actual Ponderosa that they built for continuity effect. I don't know that anybody would have really noticed it, but they did it anyway. And life imitating art or something like that. But yeah, you're right. It really is about moderation, you know? Just because somebody is not going to become an alcoholic if they take a drink, if they can do it in moderation. And so everything is about that. Entertainment can be that way. Food can be that way. Everything needs to be in moderation. That's the real challenge to all of us. And we all have a different challenge and different things. Of course, on the other side of it, even when we're talking about food, we have people who are trying to manipulate us into not doing it in moderation. You know, all the junk food suppliers, they load that stuff up so that you don't do it in moderation. You know, it keeps you unsatisfied and looking for more.
You know, and I was thinking about the lessons of the pharmakia, not to actually cure problems and cure maladies, but mm-hmm. to give you things that cover up the maladies and then extend the maladies. And I'm beginning to think that it's not just who is going to, what party or what nation state is going to win here or win there. I'm almost getting the sense that these decades and decades since World War II of all of these different flare-ups here and there, it's almost as if the military-industrial complex knows they want to continue to push conflict, but only up to a certain point. Because if they go beyond that point, then they have to literally, you know, they would get lots of production and so on and so forth, but they reach a threshold where the economy would be so bad off that I think almost as if they've realized that they can sustain themselves at the maximum point. And this is just my theory. I was thinking about it last night. I was like, I wonder if they know that if they just continually to have things simmer just below World War, mm-hmm. that's their best profit margin right there,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I could be completely wrong, But, you know, you see the way things are bubbling up there in the Middle East. Oh, Hezbollah is going to get involved and then attack Iran and that sort of stuff. And it could lead to World War III, perhaps. Or maybe they'll pull back, and then a few years from now, they'll do it again. And, of course, we got to have more increasing money going to the military-industrial complex and perpetuate those bases rather than having a complete world war that ends up, you know, moving all the chess pieces around once more. They just keep their chess pieces on there rather than having everything removed. They slowly advance into our lives. I don't know. It's just speculation.
Yeah, and of course, that all comes from the standpoint of their arrogance that they are in complete control.
Yeah.
And they aren't. You know, they might get right up to that line and then things get a little bit out of control. You know, when I was talking about it the other day, one person questioned it. I said, you know, looks like we're at DEFCON 2. There isn't any... there's not a public description of that. Most people agree that after the involvement in Ukraine, it took us to DEFCON 3. DEFCON 2 is the next level up. I don't know if what's going on in the Middle East takes us to DEFCON level 2 or not, but if there's a general consensus that we were at DEFCON 3 with what was going on with Ukraine, this whole Middle East thing looks like it is... quite a bit more volatile and dangerous from a global perspective, I think.
I agree with you. And you might have heard, I think the cat agrees with you too. She's just entered the studio. I agree with you. And, you know, it troubles me greatly to see the way that you can't criticize the policies of the state of Israel without being accused of being anti-Semitic. You can't criticize the United States government overthrow of the Ukrainian government that was elected there in late 2013, and then the imposition through Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt and all the others. And it amazes me that you've got these fatuous characters like Lindsey Graham talking about how they support Israel. In the meantime, he's literally in photographs with Oleh Tyanybok of the Sloboda Party of Ukraine, who is a Nazi.
Yeah.
I mean, literal. An avowed Nazi.
Literal, yeah.
It's just, and that's not anti-Semitic, Mr. Graham. Please, come on. You know, it's amazing. You've got Amy Klobuchar in photographs with him, Joe Biden shaking his hand, John McCain not only meeting with guys who formed the Al-Nusra Front when they were in Turkey. They've got those photographs of them standing out there on a bright, clear day out there in the desert. But you've got him in photographs with Tyanybok. It's just amazing, you know, and the thing that I often consider, David, is, you know, they say that, this is for our defense and so on. I would prefer that they actually operate according to their oath to the Constitution. If they think there's the cat, sorry, the cat is very eager. It's warm here. She wants to go outside. you know, I'd rather than coming up with all these flimsy excuses that they're defending America and that if they don't continue to give weapons to Israel, Israel will somehow fall. When they've been giving them $3.8 billion of weapons a year for years, I'd rather just be disconnected and protect myself. And, you know, you talked a little bit about that story out of Maine, and it's not that far from my home. And when I look at the forces of government on a regional level in the United States or state level in the United States, and I think about what they do to disarm us and make us more vulnerable here against criminals, it blows me away. I've got even conservatives now on talk radio here are saying first they're saying, well, you know, they seem to think that everybody in Maine is carrying a weapon, right? Which is absurd, right? With Governor Janet Mills there, they've got a lot of people who moved up there, especially from Massachusetts. It's not old-time Maine. Yeah, there's a lot of wilderness there, but if you go to a lot of the cities, they've gone very purple. Mm-hmm. The other thing about it is that the place where that man committed his murders, and alleged, but, you know, the people died. This particular man is alleged to have committed these murders, was a bowling alley and a bar. And the bowling alley serves beer. I looked up their website. Maine has a statute that prohibits anyone who owns a bar or any place that's serving alcohol from allowing anybody into their premises to carry a firearm. Mm-hmm. That's an infringement on property rights, and it's an infringement on the freedom of contract, and it's an infringement on the right to keep and bear arms in all those areas. So this guy picked soft targets, and no one had firearms there. So that's the first lesson. Then the second lesson is I'm hearing conservatives actually, they're insinuating that, well, this man had mental stability problems. He threatened people on the military base. So why wasn't somebody taking away his firearms? I'm like, you're a conservative? Now you're talking like Donald Trump. And we do the due process later, which isn't due process at all. Now you're actually saying without the terminology, red flag the guy. How about this? If he threatened people, you charge him with criminal threatening. And then you put him in jail.
And you have a trial about that. And you say, yeah, so did he threaten people? You know, what's his motivation for that? Oh, he's crazy also? Okay, well, we'll deal with that as well.
Yeah, exactly. You give in due process. And so it just like with hate crimes, I'm hearing conservatives now, especially in New England, because it's so close to home. People are talking about how, well, something's got to be done. Well, if something had to be done, clearly there was a problem with the guy. If there was a problem with the guy, he's either bad enough to be put in jail and you can prosecute him, or he's not. That's it. You put him on trial. And if you don't have him in jail, then clearly you think he's safe enough to be out on the streets.
Yeah. And of course, you know, besides the alcohol being there and it's not legal for them to take it. They had a sign at the bowling alley, you know, right above the sign that says, choose your weapon. They said, don't bring your firearm in. Yeah. And it's like, choose your weapon. You want a small bowling ball? Or you want a big bowling ball? Or you want a small caliber or a big caliber? Choose your weapon, but don't bring your weapon in here. And so again, as you point out, it's a soft target. And that sign didn't stop anything, did it? You know, I mean, that's the key. What they did was they kept people who were law-abiding, rational citizens from having weapons that they could use to protect themselves. It's just like the Luby Cafeteria in Texas and what happened with that woman who was a dentist, and she left her, you know, said, well, you can't bring it in here. It's like, all right, left her firearm in the glove compartment, and then this guy drives his truck through the side of the building there and starts shooting people. And she's, oh, I don't have my weapon with me because there was a sign there telling me I couldn't protect myself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's troubling, and you know, thank goodness we can talk about these things and try to set the record straight. And I think that, you know, with your program, you have tremendous capacity to be able to cover all these different stories. And you know, my work at MRC TV, I throw stories up to the editors and things like that, and sometimes we have disagreements. You know, the folks at MRC TV, Brent Rozelle and Mark Levin, are very good friends, and I have massive problems with many of Mark Levin's positions, especially, you know, some of his sort of rhetoric and so on. And you know, but they're very, very good to allow me. I mentioned in a recent piece about Joe Biden throwing weapons around the world at the same time that he's starting a new White House Bureau of Gun Violence Prevention. I was like, the hypocrisy of this guy is unbelievable. He wants to give billions of dollars in weapons to Ukraine, and they did allow me to hyperlink to Israel in my piece. So I thought, okay, you know, There's give and take here, and I'm very glad to be able to you know, chat with you and the opportunities you've given me to fill in for you, and then, you know, doing my streaming show to get this information out that you know, even when you have some conservatives, you say, no, we got to disagree here. You know, let me bring up a different perspective for you. And I heard one of my an acquaintances in Boston Talk Radio. She says, what are we gonna do about what's happening in Israel? And again, I said, you know, what is this we? Why do I have to have anything to do with that? You know, so to me, that's a really big deal. And it's great also to think that we can sort of circumvent some of the censors that have been brought up against us. And with the listenership and how supportive they've been, you know, I've been able to start off my Liberty Conspiracy show and my Substack, and you've been able to sustain it pretty well with all the people who came over from your show, and they're in my chat, and they're saying, hi, Gardner. I'm like, wow, you folks are just great. It's so fantastic. And
you're there, Liberty Conspiracy, you're on Rockfin Monday through Friday at what time?
Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. And then, yep, and we're streaming live at Rumble and Rockfin and on my Twitter feed, at Guard Goldsmith. And in addition to that, I have the Substack, and I'm taking little video pieces, and I'll put them out at Substack and so on and so forth. The latest one was about Halloween. There's mm-hmm. a second part about that coming out. And I just got asked, and this is something I want to mention to you, David. I just got asked, you know how Ian Freeman was convicted, and he's going to be appealing the conviction, but yeah, he's going to be
tell
going
people
to
Ian
prison.
Freeman. They may not be familiar with the name because it hasn't been covered by the mainstream media much, but it's an important precedent that's being set there. Tell people about Ian Freeman.
Well, Ian Freeman and his business partner Mark Edge came up from Florida with the Free State Project to join fellow libertarians. They moved to Keene, New Hampshire, and they started their radio show decades ago in New Hampshire, and I was doing a separate radio show in New Hampshire, and they were so kind. They invited me over. They said, hey, how'd you like to sit in with us on Wednesday nights? And I said, sure. So I would go and sit in with them, and terrific people. And Ian got started very early in Bitcoin and made amazing profits off it and started his own Bitcoin exchange and also got some of the Bitcoin kiosks for people locally, other Free State Project members who might want to start their own. Ian was prosecuted because he was dealing with a guy who wanted crypto, and that guy was defrauding people. And they said that Ian wasn't looking closely enough into in a sort of know your customer type pattern,
which they're now putting on steroids. They've ramped this up. They got 300 pages of regulations. Congress said we want you to do it, but of course the devil's going to be in the details, and the details are going to be created by the regulatory state. And the IRS has got huge 300 pages to basically end anonymity for anybody that's got crypto in any way, shape, or form, but also exposing people to a lot of identity theft risk because it is so pervasive and broad-based. And it also is set up as, I think it's one of the reasons they came after Ian, was because they said, well, there's kind of this vague thing as to whether or not you're able to get this. If you have the ability to get all this information on people, then you got to do it. And it's like, well, that's kind mm-hmm. of vague. That kind of, and so, you know, to have that case there with Ian Freeman said, if you don't collect this information, we may at some point in time determine that you were able, and now we're going to give you the Ian Freeman treatment.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the ways. You know, the appeal is going to be very complex. There's some question as to whether or not this is Bitcoin is a security or a currency. So whether it's the SEC, I mean, it's just all confused. And it's all based, again, it's how many angels can dance on the head of a deadly pin. The pin mm-hmm. shouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. The federal government should have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with this. And agents of the state, you know, if people want to police this, then let them go ahead and invest in something to police it. First, getting the state involved means that they're forcing their neighbor to pay for what they think should be necessary enforcement of something. That's immoral, period. There's nothing that excuses that. And so Ian looks like he has to go to federal prison for 8 years. Right now he's in a state penitentiary, and he can make phone calls and so on. And so I've gotten a number of phone calls from him, literally from, he's in his cell. You can hear it echoing. And he's talking to me on a tablet. He called yesterday, and he has asked me on Friday nights now. So their Free Talk Live show goes 7 days a week. And he asked me if on Friday nights I can provide recorded segments that will go out on the stations that they've connected to leave a preposition dangling. Mm-hmm. That's 175 stations.
Nice.
And I guess they're on the GCN network. Oh. So, yeah. So,
that's,
you know,
great.
Our interviews, when you want to hop on, when Tony Arterburn wants to hop on, it just had Eric Peters. Yeah. And it'll go out. I think, you know, it's up to me. They're going to be recorded. It won't be live. But it is because of you helping to keep me in the game, and not game, but in this line of work, in addition to MRC TV, that I've been able to do, you know, these little pieces here and there to just get these messages out there, you know, to get mm-hmm. around these these censorious minds.
You keep yourself in the game because you keep yourself informed, and I know you work really hard to do that. And that's the key thing. You know, you have a lot of information. People subscribe to your Substack. You put out a thing every Sunday night, and pick up some key stories. And you have a really good sense of a broad base of stories. And it's not a repetition of what you typically see, or even what I have here. It's things that you found on your own doing a lot of research. So I highly recommend your Substack to people as well.
Oh, thanks, David. And you know, one of the things that really gets me is when you know you've got allies, not to stress this too much, but when you know you've got allies who are helping you out and who believe in the principles that you believe in, that's the main thing. It's the principles that you believe in. And what really amazes me is when I think about the forces that are arrayed against us. Mm-hmm. And you brought up NewsGuard, and I gave a comment, and you're like, oh, well, he's the NewsGuard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Michael Hayden on the board of NewsGuard, a man who openly admits to, you know, overthrowing people, to being involved with spying, lying, this sort of thing. It's just incredible to think about the fact that they were getting my tax money. And they were sending MRCTV messages to say, okay, have, you know, Gardner Goldsmith respond to us about this article that we're, if you don't respond to us, we're going to claim that it's false. Mm-hmm. And all they have to do is click on the hyperlinks that are in my articles, mm-hmm. and they'll get the information.
It's amazing how many tentacles they've got. I saw something about Sidney Powell, who is now flipped, and well, we don't know if she's flipped or not. Maybe she flipped a long time ago, but they flipped her lid. But she was getting, you know, even after she said, you know, pleaded guilty to this, she came back out and still pushing her narrative about the election. And I noticed in one article that there was a guy that she relied on. There was a former CIA guy. And it's like, they've got their tentacles and everything pushing these. Is it kind of like what Pachinik did with the sting? This guy's pushing stuff to Sidney Powell. Maybe she believed it. I don't know. But, you know, they've got their stuff there. You talk about Michael Hayden. These are the guys who created the Ayatollah Khomeini as blowback, as Ron Paul always talks about. You know, they're constantly doing coups and assassinations, censorship, fake narratives. And it's just amazing how destructive and evil they are and how they're everywhere. You know, it's not just, you know, Operation Mockingbird, where they're feeding stuff to Walter Cronkite or whatever. They're everywhere. They're pushing this stuff to everybody at every level, even in alternative media, even to somebody like Sidney Powell pushing stuff to her.
It's so true. It's funny, David, because I can get frustrated and you know, you get angry sometimes when mm-hmm. or one gets angry sometimes.
I do too.
Yeah, you know, okay.
I do.
And the other thing about it is, you know, working in this field, I think a lot of times, especially I'll listen to a talk radio host in the morning, or you get a Michael Savage who sort of toned things down. But, you know, a lot of times bluster and expression of visceral anger can gin up better ratings sometimes, mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes maybe people feel like they have to emote that much more, that sort of thing. And you don't want to be too manipulative and too self-analytic and things like that. You just want to be yourself. Sometimes you naturally will get angry, but I get so tired of this shrill, you know, like Mark Levin. I get so tired of these people who oftentimes, if you were to sit down in conversation with them, you might agree on a number of things. And this is the problem that I see so often in politics and commentary about politics, where there's this fine line between attack, and I'd rather win over somebody. And mm-hmm. I don't know where that line is many times, you know, to say, look, this person is an enemy, you know, versus how can I win this person over? But
well, I think people want to see conflict. And I think that, you know, Trump understands that. The Democrats understand it. You know, James Carville said, they're going to impeach Trump. How do we get this lucky? Yeah, Trump thrives on this persecution. And it is persecution. Everybody sees that it's unequal application of the law. and he thrives on it, and he invites it. You know, we just look at what he's doing in court. You know, the judge says, don't say anything about me or the other people. So he says something about it. He gets a $10,000 fine, and he immediately does it again on Truth Social. He wants, $10,000 is nothing to him. He'll make a lot more than that with donations if everybody gets angry. And yeah. So that's a key part of it, is getting everybody on both sides of this angry. That's why I said, even when you look at something as horrific as the deliberate mutilation by these terrorists of children, killing them, and or the kid with half of his brain blown out of his skull from a bomb or whatever, you can get yourself to the point where you can fall into the trap of getting so emotionally involved in it that we should be emotionally involved. We shouldn't be cold to all this stuff, but we have to also try to keep our head and say, well, this is awful. How do we try to minimize this? Right. Instead of just running off with a bloody shirt and I'm going to get even, I'm going to get vengeance for this or whatever. We have to try to pull back and say, all right, but is there anything that we can do to try to minimize this? I don't really see any good decisions there of what we do about this stuff, frankly. But I know that, you know, if we just get ourselves ramped up and psyched up to kill the other side, whichever side we're on, that is definitely going to be the wrong way to go.
David, I'm curious, you know, as a father who you and your wife raised children, I've only experienced it as an uncle, but how you went about that balance between showing the kids the dangerous, the malicious people out there, and not getting too wrapped up in that attack mode, because you want to teach people, you know, youngsters, look, that's bad. That behavior is bad. And how you make sure that they don't get cynical, they don't get jaded, as you're giving them these examples, because there's so many examples throughout history. I'm sure a lot of that has to do with faith in God. Mm-hmm. I would assume, but I don't know if I'm expressing it right, Dave, but I was just thinking about it as I was watching you, and I thought, gee, you know, you've raised kids, you've done such a great job as a father and your wife as a mother. And I think to myself, you know, to allow the children to see the dark side and not become cynical, mm-hmm. to know, hey, watch out, this is bad stuff.
I don't know. It is difficult to not become cynical, but I think another part of it is that we have to focus on positive things, right? And if all we do is look at negative things, this is one of the reasons why when I go through the news, I really do feel compelled to get preachy, as Keith called it. You know, I feel like I got to give people some good news and some good hope. And there really is a good hope out there. And it's not all doom and gloom. You know, so there's evil, but we don't have desperation. You know, and all around us, there's darkness and evil, but we don't have to be overcome by that. And so we overcome evil with good. And one of the ways that we do that is by focusing on what is good and pure and right and just. And that is a real healing thing to us, better than any psilocybin mushrooms or anything else, is to look at what is true and just and eternal. And we have to focus on that. And that's why, you know, when I talk about this stuff, and I have to do it for my own benefit, because I can't look at this abyss on a day-to-day basis as much as I do. And, it would just drive me nuts if I didn't have something that was good and pure to look at. And so I don't want to leave people without anything, any good news when we look at all this bad news. That's the key thing.
That's well stated. You know, it's funny, David. We have some neighbors who they moved into this area before my family did, about a year before, and they had an old farmhouse and named the Driscolls. And they had three kids, all born before I, and they were more my brother and sister's age. My sister's 5 years my elder, my brother is 7 years my elder. And you make me think about, I went to visit Mr. and Mrs. Driscoll recently, and they were always just wonderful hosts. They were just great. You know, you'd go over, we'd be playing baseball in the little field that they had that no longer had crops on it and most of it. But, you know, we'd be playing softball or whatever and going sledding down the hill and that sort of stuff. And Mr. Driscoll actually did cartooning for NASA during the Apollo mission. He was part of their like PR team and stuff. Very, very good artist. And he brought out drawings that he had done of us as kids playing baseball.
Wow.
Cartoon, yeah, little spoofy cartoons with the dog chasing, running away with the ball and things like that. And he had been in the military. And I mean, he was in his 90s. He was in Korea. And you think about some of the terrible things that those people saw. You know, my dad was in World War II. He saw a man burned to death, an Australian pilot burned to death inside his plane on the tarmac. And my dad went to try to get him out. My dad was burning his hands. He couldn't get the cockpit open. Mm. And you think about some of these terrible things that people see, and yet they find the positive. And it's through, I would hope that it's through their soul and recognizing who is there behind it all. And just a little while ago, so I went to visit the Driscolls, and it was like a second hadn't gone by. And I was in their house and enjoying the smells and the scents, walking across that doorstep that I'd walked across so many times as a kid. And I saw Mr. Driscoll. He was going to be going in for heart surgery. And so he did, and he got out. But unfortunately, he passed away just a few weeks ago. So we were at the memorial service, and I was on Saturday. And I thought about how when they found out that there was a new house that was built just through the woods, behind their house, Mr. Driscoll got a lawnmower and he cut away branches and stuff, and he created a path so that we could walk over to their house, because he knew there were going to be kids there. And he maintained it, and then eventually our footsteps maintained it, and there were other friends beyond that, five kids. We had gangs of kids, just so much fun, you know, flashlight tag and all sorts of stuff. And I said, and so we were at their Methodist church, and I got up to say something at the memorial Saturday. They asked if anybody would like to come up. And I said, you know, Mr. Driscoll had an artistic eye, and he somehow could see that landscape in the woods, and he could see a trail. I was like, but he saw a greater trail. He saw a trail that was given to us by Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me think about that. If you can just see that trail, you're on the path, you know,
and it's
okay. So anyway,
what a great story that is. Before we run out of time, I know that you are a writer as well, and you got a book that is coming up. Has it been published yet, or is it still coming up?
Well, yeah, interestingly enough, as we come towards Halloween, so I have three novellas that are out. One is called Bite, and that's about a vampire hunter in Las Vegas. It's sort of a Kolchak the Night Stalker takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Wall, which is cryptoarchaeology about a Great Wall of China before 10,000 years before the Great Wall of China. And there's another one called Fishing, and that's a dark mass murderer on the loose in Western Massachusetts in the 70s, just around the end of the hippie era. And that's got a lot of dark stuff in it. So if people they want to be careful on that, some violent scenes in that.
Mm-hmm.
But the sequel to Bite has been done for ages. And I actually had a book contract. That was the one where it was actually Samhain Publishing, Sam Hain, as some people might call it. So as we come to Halloween, it's appropriate. And it was a mid-sized publishing company, but they wanted me to split my writing name from my political name. Mm-hmm. And I said, why would I do that? I'm not going to do that. So I declined the contract, and it has not been published. So there's that, which is the sequel to Bite, the novella. And then I have this other one called Teamizer, which I actually started in 1984, when I was a student at Boston University. I came up with this idea that the T was an evil underground dystopian empire. And it had gas that was making people ride to the end of the line, sort of like, he will ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. You know, Charlie, the guy.
Yeah, that's right.
And their cards are actually, their T cards, their passes are called Charlie cards. I'm like, I don't want one of those. Am I ever getting off this thing?
So, Kingston Trio, yeah.
Yeah, Kingston Trio. So so that's called Teamizer, and it happens in 1988, and Mike Dukakis is a dystopian bad guy who's trying to take over the planet by getting everybody out of their regular cars.
Into a tank?
Public transportation. And I came up with it. I didn't have the idea for, like, you know how they had cash for clunkers, right?
Yeah, all right.
Well, I had that concept in there in 1988. I started writing this novel in 1988, the Team Miser novel. And he's called Team Miser like Heat Miser and Snow Miser. They miser mm-hmm. their tokens. They won't pay their tokens because they have fingerprints on them and they track them. I had this idea that, yeah, they will give everybody a pass for the public transit because he wants everybody on public transit. It's infused with gas and hypnotizes everybody to love the government. And they'll have people trade in their gas-guzzling carbon emission cars for these public transit things. And I was thinking about that in 1988, right? But I didn't have a title for it.
Way ahead of your time. That's great.
Oh, yeah. It was nuts. And so when they had the cash for clunkers, I came up, I wrote after the fact, I went back in and call it T for Trashers, the T Pass, the Boston T Pass. It's T for Trashers. So the guy comes back. Yeah, the main character comes back from vacation and his girlfriend has sold his car. He's like, I got to get to work. Where's my car? She's like, I sold it, man. You got a T Pass. He's like,
yeah, that's where we're headed for sure. We're almost out of time. Tell everybody where they can find you. And again, I would also recommend people to go to thenightsofthestorm.com and they'll see schedules for Guard for this show, for many shows, as well as their many shows. But tell people where they can find you again, Guard.
Okay, yeah. Well, first thing I'll say and mention again, it looks like tonight I'll be going live at Liberty Conspiracy, as I do every Monday through Friday, starting at 6 on Rumble and Rockfin, and on my Twitter feed at Guard Goldsmith, G-A-R-D Goldsmith, not NewsGuard, thank goodness. And no Michael Hayden behind me, that's for sure. Although we're both bald. So 6 o'clock Monday through Friday, Rockfin and Rumble for Liberty Conspiracy, and also my Substack, Gardner Goldsmith Substack.
Great.
Then I should know by 6 o'clock tonight, if the Free Talk Live stuff goes out there, that'll be on all GCN network affiliated stations as long as they pick it up at 7 o'clock tonight.
And I have to say, before we close off, I've got to say thank you to a couple people who left tips. Thank you, Sean E., very much for the tip on Rockfin and on Rumble. Chris M90, thank you. And thank you to all of you. As a matter of fact, I had a list that I wanted to read to people. Read off the names of people who have contributed to us on Zelle. I'll do that on Monday because we're out of time. But I just wanted to thank you all. Thank you for the support this month. We are donor supported. That is the bulk of what happens with this, especially since the advertising thing with Pride Month. So thank you so much for the support. And I'll get those names. I'll read those out on Monday. Thank you all. Have a great weekend. And thank you, Guard. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Bye-bye. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.